Waterhouse tries to imagine himself one of the richest men in the world. It doesn't seem to fit.
I've been exchanging letters with a college in Washington State, he says. My fiancé put me on to them.
Fiancé? Congratulations!
She's Tagmian Australian. It seems that there's a colony of Tagmians in the Palouse Hills as well, where Washington and Oregon and Idaho all come together. Sheep herders, mostly. But there's this little college there, and they need a mathematics professor. I could be chairman of the department within a few years.
Waterhouse stands there in the Philippine jungle, smoking his cigarette and imagining this. Nothing sounds more exotic.
It sounds like a nice life, he exclaims,
as if this were the first time he had thought of such a thing.
It sounds perfectly all right to me.
The Palouse Hills seem very far away. He is impatient to begin covering the distance.
That it does, says Rudy von Hackelhaber.
You don't sound very convincing, Rudy.
I know it wouldn't be so great for you, but for me it's the cat's pajamas.
So, are you telling me you don't want in?
I'll tell you this. You said most of the money was going to charity.
Well, the college can always use a donation. If your plan works out, how about endowing a chair for me at this college? That's all I really want.
I will do that, Rudy says.
And I'll endow one for Alan, too, at Cambridge, and I'll provide both of you with laboratories full of electrical computers.
Rudy's eyes wander back to the hole in the ground where the Germans, having withdrawn most of their sentries, are making steady progress.
You know that this is nothing more than one of the outlying caches. Seed capital to finance the Golgotha work.
Yes, just as the Nips planned it.
We'll dig it up soon enough.
Sooner, now that we no longer have to worry about the crocodile,
Rudy says, and laughs. It is an honest, genuine laugh. The first time Waterhouse has ever seen him drop his guard.
Then we will go to ground until the war is over. In the meantime, maybe there will be enough left over to give you and your Tagmian bride a nice wedding present.
Our china pattern is Lavender Rose by Royal Albert, Waterhouse says.
Rudy takes an envelope out of his pocket and writes that down.
It was very good of you to come out and say hello, he mumbles around his cigarette.
Those bicycle rides in New Jersey might as well have taken place on a different planet, Waterhouse says, shaking his head.
Say did, Rudy says. And when Douglas MacArthur marches into Tokyo, it's going to be a different planet yet again. See you there, Lawrence.
See you, Rudy. Godspeed.
They embrace one more time. Waterhouse backs away and watches the shovels biting into the red mud for a few moments, then turns his back on all of the money in the world and starts walking.
Lawrence!
Rudy shouts.
Yes? Don't forget to destroy that sealed envelope you left in your office.
Waterhouse laughs.
Ah, I was just lying about that, in case someone wanted to kill me. Oh, Cecil Relief! You know how people are always saying I can keep a secret and they are always wrong? Yes? Well,
Waterhouse says,
I can keep a secret.
Cayuse. Another shockwave passes silently through the ground, setting up a pattern of waves and reflections of waves in the water that laps around their knees.
Things are going to happen very slowly now for a while. Get used to it,
says Doug Shafto.
Everyone needs a probe, a long knife or a rod, even a stick.
Doug's got a big knife, he being that kind of guy, and Amy has her Cree. Randy pulls the lightweight aluminum frame of his backpack apart to produce a couple of tubes. This takes a while, but as Doug said, everything is happening slowly now. Randy tosses one of the tubes to Enoch Root, who snatches a basically poorly aimed throw out of the air. Now that everyone is equipped, Doug Shafto gives them a tutorial on how to probe one's way through a minefield.
Like every other lesson Randy's ever imbibed, this one is sort of interesting, but only until Doug divulges the main point, which is that you can poke a mine from the side and it won't blow up. You just can't poke it vertically.
"The water is bad because it makes it hard to see what the hell we're doing,"
he says. Indeed, the water has a milky look, probably from suspended volcanic ash. You can see clearly for a foot, hazily for another foot, and below that you can see vague greenish shapes at best. Everything is covered in a uniform brown jacket of silt.
"On the other hand, it's good, because if a mine gets detonated by something other than your foot, the water's going to absorb some of the blast by flashing into steam. Now, tactically, our problem is that we are exposed to an ambush from above left, the west bank. Poor old Jackie Wu is down, and he can't protect that flank anymore. You can bet that John Wayne is covering things on the right as best as he can. Since it is the left bank that's most vulnerable, we will now head for the bank on that side and try to reach the protection of the overhang. We should not all converge on the same point. We spread out so that if one of us detonates a mine, it won't hit anyone else."
Each one of them picks a destination on the west bank and tells everyone else what it is so that they won't converge on the same place. And then each begins probing his or her way towards it. Randy tries to resist the temptation to look up. He says, after about 15 minutes,
"I know what's going on with the explosions. Wing's people are tunneling their way toward Golgotha. They're going to remove the gold through some kind of an underground conduit. It'll look like they are excavating it from their own property, but they'll actually be taking it from here."
Amy grins.
"They're robbing the bank."
Randy nods, mildly annoyed that she's not taking it more seriously.
"Wing must have been too busy with the long march and the great leap forward to buy this real estate when it was available,"
Enoch says. A few minutes later, Doug Shafto says,
"To what extent do you give a shit, Randy?"
What do you mean?
"Would you be willing to die to prevent Wing from getting that gold?"
"Probably not."
"Would you be willing to kill?"
"Well,"
says Randy, a bit taken aback,
"I said I wouldn't be willing to die, so..."
"Don't give me that golden rule shit,"
Doug says.
"If someone broke into your house in the middle of the night and threatened your family and you had a shotgun in your hands, would you use it?"
Randy involuntarily looks towards Amy, because this is not only an ethical conundrum, it's also a test to determine whether Randy is fit to be Doug's daughter's husband and the father of his grandchildren.
"Well, I should hope so,"
Randy says. Amy's pretending not to listen. The water all around them makes a spattering, searing noise. Everyone cringes. Then they realize that a handful of small pebbles was tossed into the water from above. They look up at the rim of the overhang and see a tiny reciprocating movement. Jackie Wu standing on the top of the bank, waving his hand at them.
"My eyes are going,"
Doug says.
"Does he look intact to you?"
"Yes,"
Amy says. She beams. Her pearlies are very white in the sun, and waves back. Jackie's grinning. He's carrying a long, muddy rod in one hand, his mine probe. In the other, he's got a dirty canister about the size of a clay pigeon. He holds it up and waggles it in the air.
"Nip mine!"
he shouts gleefully.
"Well, put it the fuck down, you asshole!"
Doug hollers.
"After all these years, it's gonna be incredibly unstable!"
Then he gets a look of incredulous confusion.
"Who the hell set off the other mine if it wasn't you? Someone was screaming up there."
"I haven't found him,"
Jackie Wu says.
"He stopped screaming."
"Do you think he's dead?"
"No."
"Did you hear any other voices?"
"No."
"Jesus Christ,"
Doug says.
"Someone's been shadowing us the whole way."
He turns around and looks up at the opposite bank, where John Wayne has now probed his way to the edge and is taking this all in. Some kind of hand gesture passes between them. They brought walkie-talkies, but Doug scorns them as a crutch for lightweights and wannabes. John Wayne settles down onto his belly and gets out a pair of binoculars with objective lenses as big as saucers and begins scanning Jackie Wu's side. The group in the riverbed probes onwards in silence for a while. None of them can figure out what is going on, and so it's good that they have this mind-probing thing to keep their hands and minds busy. Randy's probe hits something flexible, buried a couple of inches deep in silt and gravel. He flinches so hard he almost topples back on his ass and spends a minute or two trying to get his composure back. The silt gives everything the blank but suggestive look of sheet-covered corpses. Trying to identify the shapes makes his mind tired. He clears some gravel aside and runs his hand lightly over this thing. Dead leaves tumble through the water and tickle his forearms.
"Got an old tire down here," he says. "Big, truck-sized, and bald as an egg."
Every so often, a colored bird will descend from the shade of the overhanging jungle and flash into the sun, never failing to scare the shit out of them. The sun is brutal. Randy was only a few yards away from the shade of the bank when all of this started, and now he's pretty sure that he's going to pass out from sunstroke before he gets there. Enoch Root starts muttering in Latin at one point. Randy looks over at him and sees that he's holding up a dripping, muddy human skull. An iridescent, bright blue bird with a yellow scimitar beak mounted in a black and orange head shoots out of the jungle, seizes control of a nearby rock, and cocks its head at him. The earth shakes again. Randy flinches, and a bead curtain of sweat falls out of his eyebrows.
"Down under the rocks and mud, there's reinforced concrete," Doug says. "I could see the rebar sticking out."
Another bird or something flashes out of the shadows, headed nearly straight down toward the water at tremendous speed. Amy makes a funny grunting sound. Randy's just turning to look her way when a tremendous hammering racket opens up from above. He looks up to see a blossom of flame strobing out of the slotted flash arrestor on the muzzle of John Wayne's assault rifle. Seems like he's shooting directly across the river. Jackie Wu gets off a few shots, too. Randy, who's squatting, loses his balance from all of this head-turning and has to put out a hand to steady himself, which fortunately doesn't come down on top of a mine. He looks over at Amy. Only her head and shoulders are showing out of the water, and she's staring at nothing in particular with a look in her eyes that Randy doesn't like at all. He rises to his feet and takes a step towards her.
"Randy, don't do that,"
says Doug Shafto. Doug has already reached the shade and is only a couple of paces from the curtain of vegetation that hangs over the riverbank. There is a piece of debris riding on the surface of the river not far from Amy's face, but it is not being moved by the current. It moves when Amy moves. Randy takes another step towards her, putting his foot down on a big silt-covered boulder whose top he can make out through the milky water. He squats on that boulder like a bird and focuses again on Amy, who is maybe 15 feet away from him. John Wayne fires a series of individual shots from his rifle. Randy realizes that the piece of debris is made of feathers, bound to the butt of a narrow stick.
"Amy's been shot with an arrow," Randy says.
"Well, that's just fucking great," Doug mutters.
"Amy, where are you hit?" says Enoch Root.
Amy still can't seem to speak. She stands up awkwardly, and as she rises, the arrow emerges from the water and turns out to be lodged squarely in the middle of her right thigh. The wound is washed clean at first, but then blood wells out from around the arrow's shaft and begins to patrol down her leg in bifurcating streams. Doug's engaged in some furious exchange of hand signals with the men up above.
"You know,"
he whispers,
"I can tell that this is one of those classic deals where what was supposed to be a simple reconnaissance suddenly turns into the actual battle."
Amy grabs the shaft of the arrow with both hands and tries to snap it, but the wood is green and won't break cleanly.
"I dropped my knife somewhere," she says.
Her voice sounds calm, putting some effort into making it that way.
"I think I can deal with this level of pain for a little," she says. "But I don't like it at all." Near Amy, Randy can see another silt-covered boulder near the surface, maybe 6 feet away. He gathers himself and leaps towards it, but it topples under the impact of his foot and sends him splashing full length into the stream bed. When he sits up and gets a look at it, the boulder turns out to be a squat, cylindrical object about as big around as a dinner plate and several inches thick.
Randy, what you're looking at is a NIP anti-tank mine, Doug says. It is highly unstable with age, and it contains enough explosive to essentially decapitate everyone in our little group here. So if you would just stop being a complete asshole for a little bit, I'm sure that we would all appreciate it very much.
Amy shows Randy the palm of one hand.
I'm not looking for you to prove anything, she says. If you're trying to say you love me, send me a fucking Valentine.
I love you, Randy says.
I want you to be okay. I want you to marry me. Well, that's very romantic, Amy says sarcastically,
and then starts crying.
Aw, Jesus Christ,
Doug Shafto says.
You guys can do this later. Will you ease up? Whoever fired that arrow is long gone. The Hooks are gorillas. They know how to make themselves scarce.
It wasn't fired by a Hook, Randy says. Hooks have guns. Even I know that.
Who fired it, then?
Amy asks, working hard to get her composure back.
It looks like a cayuse arrow, Randy says.
Cayuse? You think it was fired by a cayuse?
Doug demands. Randy admires that Doug, while skeptical, is essentially open to the idea.
No,
Randy says, taking another step towards Amy and straddling the anti-tank mine.
Cayuse are extinct, measles, so it was made by a white man who is an expert in the hunting practices of Northwest Indian tribes. What else do we know about him? That he's really good at sneaking around in the jungle. And that he's so totally fucking crazy that even when he's been injured by a landmine, he's still crawling around in the undergrowth taking shots at people.
Randy's probing the riverbed as he's talking, and now he takes another step. Only 6 feet away from Amy now.
Not just anyone. He took a shot at Amy. Why? Because he's been watching. He saw Amy sitting next to me when we took that break, resting her head on my shoulder. He knows that if he wants to hurt me, the best thing he could possibly do is take a shot at her.
Why does he want to hurt you?
Enoch asks.
Because he's evil.
Enoch looks tremendously impressed.
Well, who the hell is it?
Amy hisses.
She's irritated now, which he takes to be a good sign.
His name is Andrew Loeb, Randy says. And Jackie Wu and John Wayne are never going to find him.
Jackie and John are very good,
Doug demurs. Another step. He can almost reach out and touch Amy.
That's the problem, Randy says. They're way too smart to run around in a minefield without probing every step. But Andrew Loeb doesn't give a shit. Andrew's totally out of his fucking mind, Doug. He's going to run around up there at will, or crawl, or hop, or whatever. I'd wager that Andy, with 1 foot blown off and not caring whether he lives or dies, can move through a minefield faster than Jackie when Jackie does care.
Finally, Randy's there. He crouches down before Amy, who leans forward, places a hand on each of his shoulders, and rests her weight on him, which feels good. The end of her ponytail paints the back of his neck with warm river water. The arrow's practically in his face. Randy takes his multi-purpose tool out and turns it into a saw and cuts through the shaft of the arrow, while Amy holds it steady with one fist. Then Amy splays her hand out, winds up, screams in Randy's ear, and slams the butt of the shaft. It disappears into her leg. She collapses over Randy's back and sobs. Randy reaches around behind her leg, cuts his hand on the edge of the arrowhead, grabs the shaft, and yanks it out.
I don't see evidence of arterial bleeding,
says Enoch Root, who has a good view of her from behind. Randy rises to his feet, lifting Amy into the air, collapsed over his shoulder like a sack of rice. He's embarrassed that Amy's body is basically shielding his from any further arrow attacks now, but she's making it clear that she's in no mood for walking. The shade is only 4 steps away. Shade and shelter from above.
A landmine just takes a leg or a foot, right? Randy says. If I step on one, it won't kill Amy.
Not one of your better ideas, Randy,
Doug shouts, almost contemptuously.
Just calm down and take your time.
I just want to know my options, Randy says. I can't poke around for mines while I'm carrying her.
Then I'll work my way over to you, says Enoch Root. Oh, to hell with it.
Enoch stands up and just walks over to them in half a dozen strides.
Fucking amateurs!
Doug bellows. Enoch Root ignores him, squats down at Randy's feet, and begins probing. Doug rises up out of the stream onto a few boulders strewn along the bank.
I'm gonna ascend the wall here, he says, and go up and reinforce Jackie. He and I'll find this Andrew Loeb together.
It's clear that find here is a euphemism for probably a long list of unpleasant operations. The bank is made of soft eroded stone with lumps of hard black volcanic rock jutting out of it frequently, and by clambering from one outcropping to the next, Doug is able to make his way halfway up the bank in the time it takes Enoch Rue to locate one safe place to plant their feet. Randy wouldn't want to be the guy who just shot an arrow into Doug Shafto's daughter. Doug is stymied for a moment by the overhang, but by traversing the bank a short distance, he's able to reach a tangle of tree roots that's almost as good as a ladder to the top.
She's shivering, Randy announces. Amy's shivering.
She's in shock. Keep her head low and her legs high, says Enoch Root.
Randy shifts Amy around, nearly losing his grip on a blood-greased leg. One of the things that Goto Dengo spoke of during their dinner in Tokyo was the Nipponese practice of tuning streams and gardens by moving rocks from place to place. The sound of a brook is made by patterns in the flow of water, and those patterns encode the presence of rocks on the stream bed. Randy found in this an echo of the Palouse Winds thing and said so, and Goto Dengo either thought it was terribly insightful or else was being polite. In any case, several minutes later, there is a change in the sound of the water that is flowing around them. And so Randy naturally looks upstream to see that a man is standing in the water about a dozen feet away from them. The man has a shaved head that is sunburned as red as a three-ball. He's wearing what used to be a decent enough business suit, which has practically become one with the jungle now. It is impregnated with red mud, which has made it so heavy that it pulls itself all out of shape as he totters to a standing position. He's got a great big pole, a wizard staff. He has planted it in the riverbed and is sort of climbing up it hand over hand. When he gets fully upright, Randy can see that his right leg terminates just below the knee, although the bare tibia and fibula stick out for a few inches. The bones are scorched and splintered. Andrew Loeb has fashioned a tourniquet from sticks and a $100 silk necktie that Randy's pretty sure he has seen in the windows of airport duty-free shops. This has throttled back the flow of blood from the end of his leg to a rate comparable to what you would see coming out of Mr. Coffee during its brew cycle. Once Andy has gotten himself fully upright, he smiles brightly and begins to move towards Randy and Amy and Enoch, hopping on his intact leg and using the wizard's staff to keep from falling down. In his free hand, he is carrying a great big knife, Bowie-sized, but with all of the extra spikes, saw blades, blood grooves, and other features that go into a really top-of-the-line fighting and survival knife. Neither Enoch nor Amy sees Andrew. Randy has this insight now that Doug pointed him in the direction of earlier, namely that the ability to kill someone is basically a mental stance, and not a question of physical means. A serial killer armed with a couple of feet of clothesline is far more dangerous than a cheerleader with a bazooka. Randy feels certain all of a sudden that he's got the mental stance now. But he doesn't have the means. And that is the problem, right there in a nutshell. The bad guys tend to have the means. Andy's looking him right in the eye and smiling at him, precisely the same smile you would see on the face of some old acquaintance you had just accidentally run into on an airport concourse. As he approaches, he's kind of shifting the big knife around in his hand, getting it into the right grip for whatever kind of attack he's about to make. It is this detail that finally breaks Randy out of his trance and causes him to shrug Amy off and drop her into the water behind him. Andrew Loeb takes another step forward and plants his wizard staff, which suddenly flies into the air like a rocket, leaving a steaming crater behind in the water, which instantly fills in, of course. Now Andy's standing there like a stork, having miraculously kept his balance. He bends his one remaining knee and hops towards Randy, then does it again. Then he is dead, and toppling backwards, and Randy is deaf, or maybe it happens in some other order. Enoch Root has become a column of smoke with a barking, spitting white fire in the center. Andrew Loeb has become a red, comet-shaped disturbance in the stream, marked by a single arm thrust out of the water, a French cuff that is still uncannily white, a cufflink shaped like a little honeybee, and a spindly fist gripping the huge knife. Randy turns around and looks at Amy. She's levered herself up on one arm. In her opposite hand, she's got a sensible, handy sort of revolver which she is aiming in the direction of where Andrew Loeb fell. Something's moving in the corner of Randy's eye. He turns his head quickly. A coherent, wraith-shaped cloud of smoke is drifting away from Enoch over the surface of the river, just coming into the sun, where it is suddenly brilliant. Enoch is just standing there holding a great big old 45 and moving his lips in the unsettled cadences of some dead language. Andrew's fingers loosen. The knife falls and the arm relaxes, but does not disappear. An insect lands on his thumb and starts to eat it. Black Chamber.
Well, Waterhouse says, I know a thing or two about keeping secrets.
I know that perfectly well, says Colonel Earl Comstock. It is a fine quality. It is why we want you. After the war.
A formation of bombers flies over the building, rattling its shell-shocked walls with a drone that penetrates into their sinuses. They take this opportunity to heave their massive Buffalo China coffee cups off their massive Buffalo China saucers and sip weak greenish army coffee.
Don't let that kind of thing fool you,
Comstock hollers over the noise, glancing up toward the bombers which bank majestically to the north, going up to blast hell out of the incredibly tenacious Tiger of Malaya.
People in the know think that the Nips are on their last legs. It's not too early to think about what you will be doing after the war.
I told you, sir, getting married and,
yeah, teaching math at some little school out west.
Comstock sips coffee and grimaces. The grimace is as tightly coupled to the sip as recoil is to the pull of a trigger.
Sounds delightful, Waterhouse, it really does. Well, there's all kinds of fantasies that sound great to us sitting here on the outskirts of what used to be Manila, breathing gasoline fumes and swatting mosquitoes. I've heard 100 guys, mostly enlisted men, rhapsodize about mowing the lawn. That's all those guys can talk about is mowing the lawn. But when they get back home, will they want to mow the lawn?
No.
Right. They only talk like that because mowing the lawn sounds great when you're sitting in a foxhole picking lice off your nuts.
One of the useful things about military service is that it gets you acclimatized to having loud, blustery men say rude things to you. Waterhouse shrugs it off.
Could be I'll hate it, he concedes.
At this point, Comstock sheds a few decibels, scoots closer, and gets fatherly with him.
That's not just you, he says. Your wife might not be crazy about it either.
Oh, she loves the open countryside. Doesn't care for cities.
You wouldn't have to live in a city. With the kind of salary we are talking about here, Waterhouse.
Comstock pauses for effect, sips, grimaces, and lowers his voice another notch.
You could buy a nice little Ford or a Chevy.
He stops to let that sink in.
With a V8 that would give you power to burn. You could live 10-20 miles away and drive in every morning at a mile a minute.
10 or 20 miles away from where? I'm not clear yet on whether I would be working in New York for Electrical Till or in Fort Meade for this new thing.
We're thinking of calling it the National Security Agency, Comstock says. Of course, even that name is secret.
I understand.
There was a similar thing between the wars called the Black Chamber, which has a nice ring to it, but a bit old-fashioned.
That was disbanded.
Yes, Secretary of State Stimson did away with it. He said, gentlemen, do not read one another's mail.
Comstock laughs out loud at this. He laughs for a long time.
The world has changed, hasn't it, Waterhouse? Without reading Hitler's and Tojo's mail, where would we be now, huh?
We would be in a heck of a fix, Waterhouse concedes.
You've seen Bletchley Park, you've seen Central Bureau in Brisbane. Those places are nothing less than factories, mail reading on an industrial scale.
Comstock's eyes glitter at the idea. He is staring through the walls of the building now like Superman with his X-ray vision.
It is the way of the future, Lawrence. War will never be the same. Hitler is gone. The Third Reich is history. Nippon is soon to fall, but this only sets the stage for the struggle with communism. To build a Bletchley Park big enough for that job, why, hell, we'd have to take over the whole state of Utah or something. That is, if we did it the old-fashioned way, with girls sitting in front of Typex machines.
For the first time now, Waterhouse gets it. The digital computer, he says.
The digital computer, Comstock echoes.
He sips and grimaces.
A few roomfuls of that equipment would replace an acre of girls sitting in front of Typex machines.
Comstock now gets a naughty conspiratorial grin on his face and leans forward. A drop of sweat rolls off the point of his chin and plunks into Waterhouse's coffee.
It would also replace a lot of the stuff that Electrical Till manufactures. So, you see, there is a confluence of interests here.
Comstock sets his cup down.
Perhaps he is finally convinced that there is no deep stratum of good coffee concealed underneath the bad. Perhaps coffee is a frivolous thing compared to the importance of what he is about to divulge. I have been in constant touch with my higher-ups at Electrical Till, and there is intense interest in this digital computer business. Intense interest. The machinery has already been set in motion for a business deal, and Waterhouse, I only tell you this because, as we have established, you are good at keeping secrets.
I understand, sir.
A business deal that would bring Electrical Till, the world's mightiest manufacturer of business machines, together with the government of the United States to construct a machine room of titanic proportions at Fort Meade, Maryland, under the aegis of this new Black Chamber, the National Security Agency. It is an installation that will be the Bletchley Park of our upcoming war against the communist threat, a threat both internal and external.
And you would like me to get mixed up in this somehow?
Comstock blinks. He draws back. He is suddenly cool and remote. To be absolutely frank, Waterhouse, this thing will go forward with or without you.
Waterhouse chuckles. I figured that.
All I'm doing is giving you a greased path, as it were, because I respect your skills and I have a certain, I don't know, fatherly affection for you as the result of our work together. I hope you don't mind my saying so.
Not at all.
Say! And speaking of that, Comstock stands up, walking around behind his terrifyingly neat desk, and plucks a single piece of typing paper off the blotter. How are you coming with Arethusa?
Still archiving the intercepts as they come in. Still haven't broken it.
I have some interesting news about Arethusa.
Oh, you do?
Yes. Something you're not aware of.
Comstock scans the paper.
After we took Berlin, we scooped up all of Hitler's crypto people and flew 35 of them back to London. Our boys there have been interrogating them in detail, filling in a lot of blanks for us. What do you know about this Rudolf von Hackelheber fellow?
All traces of moisture have disappeared from Waterhouse's mouth. He sips and does not grimace.
knew him a little at Princeton. Dr. Turing and I thought we saw his handiwork in Azure Pufferfish.
You are right, Comstock says, rattling the paper. But did you know that he was very likely a communist?
I had no knowledge of his political leanings.
Well, he is a homo, for one thing, and Hitler hated homos, so that might have pushed him into the arms of the Reds. Also, he was working under a couple of Russians at Hauptgruppe B. Supposedly, they were czarists and pro-Hitler, but you never know. Well, anyway, in the middle of the war, sometime in late 43, he apparently fled to Sweden. Isn't that funny?
Why is it funny?
If you have the wherewithal to escape from Germany, why not go to England and fight for the good guys? No, he went to the east coast of Sweden, directly across the water, Comstock says portentously, from Finland, which borders on the Soviet Union. He slaps the page down on his desk. Seems pretty clear-cut to me. So, and now we have these goddamn Arethusa messages bouncing around, some of them emanating from right here in Manila. Some coming from a mysterious submarine, not a nip submarine, evidently. It seems very much like a secret espionage ring of some description, wouldn't you say so?
Waterhouse shrugs.
Interpretation isn't my department. It is mine, Comstock says. And I say it's espionage. Probably directed from the Kremlin. Why? Because they are using a cryptosystem that, according to you, is based on Azure Pufferfish, which was invented by the communist homo Rudolf von Heckelheber. I hypothesize that von Heckelheber only stayed in Sweden long enough to get some shut-eye and maybe cornhole some nice blonde boy and then scooter right over to Finland and from there to the waiting arms of Lavrenti Beria.
Well, gosh, Waterhouse says. What do you think we should do?
I have taken this Arethusa thing off the back burner. We have become lazy and complacent. More than once, our huffed-up people observed Arethusa messages emanating from this general area.
Comstock raises his index finger to a map of Luzon. Then he catches himself, realizing that this would be more dignified if he used a pointer. He bends down and grabs a long pointer. Then he realizes he is too close and has to back up a couple of steps in order to get the business end of the pointer on the part of the map that his index finger was touching a moment earlier. Finally situated, he vigorously circles a coastal region south of Manila along the strait that separates Luzon from Mindoro.
South of all these volcanoes, along the coast here. This is where that submarine has been skulking around. We haven't gotten a good fix on the bastard yet, because all of our huff-duff stations have been way up north here.
The pointer swoops up for a lightning raid on the Cordillera Central, where Yamashita has gone to ground.
But not anymore.
Down swoops the pointer, vengefully.
I have ordered several huff-duff units to set up in this area and at the northern end of Mindoro. Next time that submarine transmits an Arethusa message, we'll have Catalina's overhead within 15 minutes.
Well, Waterhouse volunteers.
Maybe I should get cracking on breaking that darn code, then.
If you could accomplish that, Waterhouse, it would be brilliant.
It would mean victory in this, our first cryptological skirmish with the communists. It would be a splendid kickoff for your relationship with Electrical Till and the NSA. We could set your new bride up with a nice house in the horse country, a gas stove, and a Hoover that would make her forget all about the Palouse Hills.
Sounds pretty darn inviting, Waterhouse says. I just can't hold myself back. And with that, he's out the door. In a stone room in a half-ruined church, Enoch Root looks out of a busted window and grimaces.
I am not a mathematician, he says. I only did the calculations that Dengo asked me to do. You will have to ask him to encrypt the message.
Find another place for your transmitter, Waterhouse says, and be ready to use it on short notice. Goto Dengo is right where he said he would be, sitting on the bleachers above third base. The ball field has been repaired, but no one is playing now. He and Waterhouse have the place to themselves, except for a couple of poor Filipino peasants driven down to Manila by the war up north, scavenging for dropped popcorn.
What you ask is very dangerous,
he says.
It will be totally secret,
Waterhouse says.
Think into the future,
says Gododango.
One day these digital computers you speak of will break the Arethusa code. Is this not so?
It is so. Not for many years.
Say 10 years. Say 20 years. The code is broken. Then they will go back and find all of the old Arethusa messages, including the message that you want to send to your friends, and read them. So?
Yes, it is true.
And then they will see this message that says, "Warning, warning, Comstock has laid a trap. The Huffduff stations are waiting for you. Do not transmit." Then they will know that there was a spy in Comstock's office. Certainly they will know it was you.
You're right, you're right. I didn't think of that, Waterhouse says.
Then he realizes something else.
They'll know about you, too.
Gododango blanches.
Please, I am so tired.
One of the Arethusa messages spoke of a person named G.D. Gododango puts his head in his hands and is perfectly motionless for a long time. He does not have to say it. He and Waterhouse are imagining the same thing. 20 years in the future, Nipponese police burst into the office of Gododango, prosperous businessman, and arrest him for being a communist spy.
Only if they decrypt those old messages, Waterhouse says.
But they will. You said that they will decrypt them.
Only if they have them, Waterhouse says.
But they do have them.
They are in my office.
Gododango is shocked, horrified.
You are not thinking to steal the messages.
That's exactly what I'm thinking.
But this will be noticed.
No. I will replace them with others.
The voice of Alan Matheson Turing shouts above the buzz of the Project X synchronization tone. The long-playing record, filled with noise, spins on its turntable.
You want the latest in random numbers?
Yeah,
some mathematical function that will give me nearly perfect randomness. I know you've been working on this.
Oh, yes, Turing says.
I can provide a much higher degree of randomness than what is on these idiotic phonograph records that you and I are staring at.
How do you do it?
I have in mind a zeta function that is simple to understand, extremely tedious to calculate. I hope you have laid in a good stock of valves.
Don't worry about that, Alan.
Do you have a pencil?
Of course.
Very well, then,
Turing says, and begins to call out the symbols of the function. The basement is suffocatingly hot because Waterhouse shares it with a co-worker who generates thousands of watts of body heat. The co-worker both eats and shits ETC cards. What it does in between is Waterhouse's business. He spends about 24 hours sitting there, stripped to the waist, his undershirt wrapped around his head like a turban so he won't drop sweat into the works and cause short circuits, flicking switches on the digital computer's front panel, swapping patch cords on the back, replacing burned-out tubes and bulbs, probing malfunctioning circuits with an oscilloscope. In order to make the computer execute Alan's random number function, he even has to design a new circuit board on the fly and solder it together. The entire time he knows Gododango and Enoch Root are at work somewhere in Manila with scratch paper and pencils, encrypting the final Arethusa message. He doesn't have to wonder whether they've transmitted it. He will be told. Indeed, a lieutenant from the intercept section comes in at about 5 in the evening, looking triumphant.
You got an Arethusa message?
2 of them,
the lieutenant says, holding up 2 separate sheets with grids of letters on them.
A collision.
A collision?
A transmitter opened up down south first.
On land or
at sea? Off the northeast end of Palawan. They transmitted this.
He waves one of the sheets.
Then, almost immediately, a transmitter in Manila came on the air and sent this.
He waves the other sheet.
Does Colonel Comstock know about this?
Oh, yes, sir. He was just leaving for the day when the messages came through. He's been on the horn to his Huffduff people, the Air Force, the whole bit. He thinks we've got the bastards.
Well, before you get carried away celebrating, could you do me a favor?
Yes, sir.
What did you do with all of the original intercept sheets for the archived Arethusa messages?
They're filed, sir. Do you want to see them?
Yes, all of them. I need to check them against the versions on the ETC cards. If Arethusa works the way I think it does, then even a single mistranscribed letter could render all of my calculations useless. I'll go and fetch them, sir. I'm not going home anyway.
You're not?
Why, no, sir. I want to wait around to see how it all comes out with that darn submarine.
Waterhouse goes to the oven and takes out a brick of hot blank ETC cards. He has learned that he has to keep the cards hot, or else they will soak up the tropical humidity and jam the machinery. So before he moved the digital computer into this room, he insisted that a whole bank of ovens be installed. He drops the hot cards into the hopper of a card punching machine, sits down at the keyboard, and clips the first intercept sheet up in front of him. He begins to punch the letters into it, one by one. It is a short message. It fits onto three cards. Then he begins punching in the second message. The lieutenant comes in carrying a cardboard box.
All of the original Arethusa intercept sheets.
Thank you, Lieutenant.
The lieutenant looks over his shoulder.
Can I help you transcribing those messages?
No.
The best way for you to help me would be to refill my water pitcher and then don't bother me for the rest of the night. I have a bee in my bonnet about this Arethusa business.
Yes, sir,
says the lieutenant, insufferably cheerful about the fact that the mysterious submarine is even now on the run from Catalina bombers. Waterhouse finishes punching in the second message, though he already knows what it would say if it were decrypted. Trap. Repeat trap. Do not transmit. Stop. Huff-duff units nearby. He takes those cards out of the puncher's output tray and places them neatly in the box along with the cards containing all of the previous Arethusa messages. He then takes the entire contents of this box, a brick of messages about a foot thick, and puts them into his attaché case. He unclips the two fresh intercept slips from the card puncher and puts them on top of the stack of older slips. The brick of cards in his attaché case and the pile of slips in his hand contain exactly the same information. They are the only copies in all the world. He flips through them to make sure that they contain all of the critical intercepts, such as the long message giving the location of Golgotha and the one that mentions Godo Dango's initials. He puts the whole stack of slips on top of one of the ovens. He dumps a foot-thick stack of hot blank cards into the input hopper of the card punch. He connects the punch's control cable up to the digital computer so that the computer can control it. Then he starts the program he has written, the one that generates random numbers according to Turing's function. Lights flash, and the card reader whirs as the program is loaded into the computer's RAM. Then it pauses, waiting for input. The function needs a seed. A stream of bits that will get it going. Any seed will do. Waterhouse thinks about it for a moment, and then types in Comstock. The card punch rumbles into action. The stack of blanks begins to get shorter. Punched cards skitter into the output tray. When it's finished, Waterhouse pulls one of them out, holds it up to the light, and looks at the pattern of tiny rectangular holes punched out of the manila. A constellation of doorways.
It'll look like any other encrypted message, he explained to Godo Dango, up on the bleachers. But the crypto boys,
he almost said the NSA,
can run their computers on them forever and never break the code because there is no code.
He puts this stack of freshly punched cards into the box labeled Arethusa Intercepts and puts it back in its place on the shelf. Finally, before leaving the lab, he goes back over to that oven and slides the corner of that stack of intercept sheets very close to a pilot light. It is reluctant to catch, so he gives it some help with a flick of his Zippo. He stands back and watches the pile burn for a while, until he's sure that all of the strange information on those sheets has been destroyed. Then he goes out into the hallway in search of a fire extinguisher. Upstairs, he can hear Comstock's boys, gathered around the radio, baying like hounds. Passage. When he has picked himself up off the deck and his ears have stopped ringing, Bischoff says,
"Take her down to 75 meters."
The dial that tells their depth says 20. Somewhere, perhaps 100 meters above them, crewmen of a circling bomber are setting their depth charges to explode when they have sunk to a depth of 20. And so 20 is a bad place to be for a while. The dial does not move, though, and Bischoff has to repeat the command. Everyone on the boat must be deaf. Either that or the V-Million has sustained damage to her dive planes. Bischoff presses his skull against a bulkhead, and even though his ears don't work so well anymore, he can feel the whine of the turbines. At least they have power. They can move. But Catalina's can move faster. Say what you want about those old clanking diesel U-boats. They at least had guns on them. You could surface and go out on the decks in the sun and the air and fight back. But in the V-Million, this swimming rocket, the only weapon is secrecy. In the Baltic, fine. But this is the Mindoro Strait, which is an ocean of window glass. V-Million might as well be suspended in midair from piano wires, searchlights crossing on it. The needle on the dial is moving now, passing down through 25 meters. The deck twists under Bischoff's feet as she recoils from another depth charge, but he can tell from the way it twists that this one is detonated too high to deal serious damage. From habit, he glances at the dial that tells their speed and notes it down along with the time. 17:46 hours. The sun must be lower and lower in the sky, its light glancing off the tops of the waves, forcing the pilots of the Catalinas to peer down through a screen of bright noise. Another hour and V-Million will be completely invisible. Then, if Bischoff has kept careful records of their speed and course, dead reckoning will tell them approximately where they are and enable them to run down the Palawan Passage in the night, or to cut west across the South China Sea, if that seems like a good idea. But really, he is hoping to find some nice pirate cove on the north coast of Borneo, marry a nice orangutan, and raise a little family. The face of the depth dial says Tiefenmesser in that old-fashioned Gothic lettering that the Nazis loved so much. Messer means a gauge or meter, but it also means knife. Das Messer sitzt mir in der Kehle. The knife is at my throat. I am face to face with doom. When the knife is at your throat, you don't want it to move the way the needle on the Tiefenmesser is moving now. Every tick on the dial's face is another meter of water between Bischoff and the sun and the air. I would like to be a Messerschmitt, Bischoff mutters. A man who smashes Messers with a hammer, but also a beautiful thing that flies. You'll see light and breathe fresh air again, Gunther, says Rudolf von Heckelheber, a civilian mathematician who really has no place on the bridge of a U-boat during a fight to the death. But there's no good place for him to be, and so here he is. Now this is a fine thing for Rudy to say, a lovely show of support for Gunther. But saving the life of everyone on the U-boat and getting its cargo of gold to safety now depends on Gunther's emotional stability, and especially on his confidence. Sometimes, if you want to live and breathe tomorrow, you have to dive into the black depths today, and that is a leap of faith. Faith in your U-boat and your crew, beside which the saints' religious epiphanies amount to nothing. So Rudy's promise is soon forgotten. Or at least it is forgotten by Bischoff. Bischoff derives strength from having heard it, and from similar things that members of his crew say to him, and from their grins and thumbs up and slaps on the shoulder, and their displays of pluck and initiative, the clever repairs that they make to broken plumbing and overtaxed engines. Strength gives him faith, and faith makes him into a good U-boat skipper. Some would say the best who ever lived, but Bischoff knows many others better than him whose bodies are trapped in knuckles of imploded metal on the floor of the North Atlantic. It comes together like this. The sun has gone down, as it can be relied on to do every day, even when you are a beleaguered U-boat. The V-Million has reamed a tunnel through the Palawan Passage, screaming along for several hours at the completely unreasonable speed of 29 knots, 4 times as fast as U-boats are supposed to be capable of going. The Americans will have drawn a small circle around the point in the ocean where the mysterious U-boat was last sighted. But the speed of the V-Million is 4 times as great as they think it is. The real circle is 4 times as wide as the one they've drawn. The Yanks won't expect them to surface where they are.
but they have to surface because the V-Million wasn't made to run at 29 knots forever. She burns fuel and hydrogen peroxide at a ridiculous rate when both of her 6,000-horsepower turbines are spinning. There is plenty of fuel remaining, but she runs out of hydrogen peroxide at about midnight. She has a few miserable batteries and electric motors that just barely suffice to get her up to the surface. But then she has to breathe air for a while and run her diesels. So the V-Million and a few crew members get to enjoy some fresh air. Bischoff doesn't, because he is dealing with new complexities that have arisen in the engine room. This probably saves his life, because he doesn't even know they're being strafed until he hears the cannon rounds drumming against the outer hull. Then it is the same old drill, the crash dive, which was so exciting when he was a young man practicing it in the Baltic, and has become so tedious for him now. Looking up through a hatch, he gets a moment's glimpse of a single star in the sky before the view is blocked by mutilated crewmen being fed down from above. Only 5 minutes later, the depth charge scores a direct hit on the stern of the V-Million and tears a hole through both the outer and the pressure hull. The deck angles beneath Bischoff's feet, and his ears begin to pop. On a submarine, both of these are bad omens. He can hear hatches clanging shut as the crew tried to stem the advance of the water towards the bow. Each one seals the fate of whomever happens to be aft of it. But they're all dead anyway. It is just a question of timing now. Those hatches are not meant to stem 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 atmospheres of pressure. They give way. The pressure spikes upwards as the bubble of air in the front of the V-Million suddenly halves its volume, then halves it again and again. Each wave of pressure comes as sudden crushing pressure on Bischoff's thorax, driving all the air out of his lungs. Because the bow is pointed straight up, like a needle on a meter, there's no deck to stand on. And every time a bulkhead yields and the water level shoots upwards towards the bow, it leaves them suddenly submerged, with crushed and evacuated lungs, and they must swim up and find the air bubble again. But finally, the mangled stern of the boat spikes into the seafloor and the V-Million settles down, the forwardmost cabin rotating around them, tremendous rock-crushing noises all around as a coral reef is destroyed by the boat's falling hull. And then it's finished. Gunter Bischoff and Rudolf von Heckelhaber are together in a safe, cozy bubble of compressed air. All of the air that used to be in the V-Million, reduced to a pocket the size of a car. It's dark. He hears Rudy undoing the latches on his aluminum briefcase.
Don't strike a match, Bischoff says.
This air is compressed. It will burn like a flare.
That would be terrible, Rudy says, and instead turns on a flashlight. The light comes on and immediately dims and goes brown and shrinks to a tiny red speck, the glowing remains of the filament in the bulb.
Your light bulb has imploded, Bischoff explains. But at least I got a little glimpse of you, with that silly look on your face.
You two have looked better, Rudy says. Bischoff can hear him closing up the briefcase, snapping the latches into place.
Do you think my briefcase will float here forever?
Eventually, the pressure hull above us will corrode. The air will escape from it in a thin line of bubbles that will grow into gyrating nebulas of foul air as they rush towards the surface. The water level will rise and press your briefcase up against what is left of the pressure hull's forward dome, and it will fill with water. But still, there will be a little pocket of air in one corner of your briefcase, perhaps.
I was thinking of leaving a note in it.
If you do, better address it to the United States government.
Department of the Navy, you think?
Department of Spying. What do they call it? The OSS?
Why do you say this?
They knew where we were, Rudy. The Catalinas were waiting for us.
Maybe they found us with radar.
I allowed for radar. Those planes came even faster. You know what it means.
Tell me.
It means that those who were hunting us knew how fast the V-Million could go.
Ah, so that is why you think of spies.
I gave Bobby the plans, Rudy.
The plans for the Vermilion?
Yes. So that he could buy forgiveness from the Americans.
Well, in retrospect, maybe you shouldn't have done that. But I do not blame you for it, Gunther. It was a magnificent gesture.
Now they will come down and find us.
After we're dead, you mean?
Yes. The whole plan is ruined.
Ah, well, it was a nice conspiracy while it lasted. Perhaps Enoch Root will display some adaptability.
You really think spies will come down to go through this wreck?
Who knows? Bischoff says. Why are you worrying about it?
I have the coordinates of Golgotha here in my briefcase,
Rudy says.
But I know for certain that they are not written down anywhere else in Vermilion.
You know that because you're the one who decrypted that message.
Yes. Maybe I should burn the message now.
It would kill us,
Bischoff says.
But at least we would die with some warmth and some light.
You are going to be on a sandy beach, sunning yourself in a few hours, Gunther,
Rudy says.
Stop it.
I made a promise which I intend to keep,
Rudy says. There is a movement in the water, the strangled splash of a kicking foot being drawn under the surface.
Rudy! Rudy!
Bischoff says. But he is alone in a black dome of silence. A minute later, a hand grips his ankle. Rudy climbs up his body like a ladder and thrusts his head above the surface and howls for air. But this air is the good stuff, 16 times as much oxygen in a single lungful. He feels better quickly. Bischoff holds him while he calms down.
The hatch is open,
Rudy says.
I saw light through it. The sun is up, Gunther.
Let's go, then.
You go. I'll stay and burn the message.
Rudy's opening his briefcase again, feeling through papers with his hands, taking something out, closing the briefcase again. Bischoff cannot move.
I strike the match in 30 seconds,
Rudy says. Bischoff launches himself towards Rudy's voice and wraps his arms around him in the dark.
I'll find the others,
Bischoff says.
I'll tell them that some fucking American spy is onto us, and we'll get that gold first and we'll keep it out of their hands. Go,
Rudy cries.
I want everything to happen fast now.
Bischoff kisses him once on each cheek and then dives. Ahead of him is faint blue-green light, coming from no particular direction. Rudy swam to the hatch, opened it, and swam back, and was almost dead when he returned. Bischoff has to find that hatch and then swim all the way to the surface. He knows that it will be impossible. But then much brighter, warmer light floods the interior of the Vermilion. Bischoff looks back and up, and sees the forward end of the pressure hull turned into a dome of orange fire. The silhouette of a man centered in it, lines of welds and rivets spreading away from that center like the meridians of a globe. It's bright as day. He turns around and swims easily away down the gangway into the control room and finds the hatch, a disk of cyan light.
A life ring is pressed up against what is now the ceiling of this room. He grabs it and wrestles it down into the middle of the cabin, then shoves it before him through the hatch and kicks his way through. There's coral all around him, and it's beautiful. He'd love to stay and sightsee, but he's got responsibilities above. He keeps a grip on the life preserver, and although he doesn't feel himself moving, he sees the coral dropping away below. There's a big gray thing lying on it, bubbling and bleeding, and this gets smaller and smaller, like a rocket flying away into the sky. He looks up into the water that is streaming over his face. Both of Bischoff's arms are above his head, gripping the rim of the life ring, and he sees a disk of sunlight through it, getting brighter and redder as he ascends. His knees begin to hurt. Liquidity. The rest of it all seems like history to Randall Lawrence Waterhouse. He knows that, technically speaking, it is the present and all of the really important stuff is future, but what's important to him is finished and settled. He would like to get on with his life, now that he's got one. They carry Amy back to the missionary compound, and the doctor who is there does some work on her leg, but they can't get her out to the hospital in Manila because Wing has blockaded them in there. This ought to seem threatening, but actually just seems stupid and annoying to them after they've had a little while to get used to it. The people who are doing it are Chinese communist Geronto apparatchiks, backed up by a few boot-licking cronies within the local government, and none of them has the slightest appreciation of things like encrypted spread-spectrum packet radio, which makes it easy for people like Doug and Randy to communicate with the outside world and explain precisely what is going on. Randy's blood type is compatible with Amy's, and so he lets the doctor suck him nearly dry. The lack of blood seemingly halves his IQ for a day or two, but even so, when he sees Douglas MacArthur Shafto drawing up the shopping list of men and gear that they need to dig up Golgotha, he has enough presence of mind to say, strike all of that stuff. Forget the trucks and jackhammers and dynamite, the unloaders and excavators and tunnel-boring machines, and just give me a drill, a couple of pumps, and a few thousand gallons of fuel oil. Doug gets it right away. As indeed, how could he not? Since he basically gave Randy the idea by telling him old war legends about his father. They get the shopping list out to Abby and Gododenga with no trouble at all. Wing keeps them blockaded in the compound for a week. The subterranean explosions continue to shake the earth. Amy's leg gets infected, and the doctor comes this close to sawing it off to save her life. Enoch Root spends some time alone with her, and suddenly her leg gets a lot better. He explains that he applied a local folk remedy, but Amy refuses to say anything about it. Meanwhile, the rest of them kill time by clearing mines from around Golgotha and trying to localize those explosions. The verdict seems to be that Wing still has most of a kilometer of hard rock to tunnel through in order to get access to Golgotha, and he's only making a few dozen meters per day. They know that all hell is breaking loose in the outside world because media and military helicopters keep flying over the place. One day, a Goto engineering chopper lands in the compound. It's got Earth-imaging sonar gear. And more importantly, it's got antibiotics, which have a nearly magical impact on the jungle's bugs in Amy's leg, which have never even met penicillin, much less this state-of-the-art stuff that makes penicillin look like chicken noodle soup. Amy's fever breaks in a couple of hours, and she's hobbling within a day. The road gets opened up again, and then their problem becomes trying to keep people out. It is jammed with media, opportunistic gold seekers, and nerds. All of them apparently think they are present at some kind of radical societal watershed, as if global society has gotten so screwed up that the only thing to do is shut down and reboot it. Randy sees people holding up banners with his name on them, and tries not to think about what this implies. The truckloads of equipment almost cannot make it through this traffic jam, but they do. And there's another really frustrating and tedious week of hauling all of the shit through the jungle. Randy spends most of his time hanging around with the Earth-imaging sonar crew. They have this very cool gear that Goto Engineering uses to do CAT scans of the Earth that they are about to dig into. By the time all of the heavy equipment is in place, Randy's got the entirety of Golgotha imaged down to a resolution of about a meter. He could fly through it in virtual reality if he were into that kind of thing. As it is, all he needs is to decide where to drill his three holes, two from the top down into the main vault, and then one from the side, coming in almost horizontally from the riverbank, but at a gentle upward angle, until it enters what he thinks is the lowest sump in the main chamber, the drain hole. Someone arrives from the outside world and convinces Randy he is on the cover of both Time and Newsweek. Randy doesn't consider it to be good news. He knows that he's got a new life. He had a particular mental image of what that new life is, mostly being married to Amy and minding his own business until he dies of old age. It did not enter his calculations that being on the cover of news weeklies and people standing in the jungle holding banners with his name on them would in any way characterize his life. Now he never wants to leave the jungle. The pumps are mighty house-sized things. They have to be to fight the back pressure that they are going to engender. Goto Dango's young engineers see to it that they are mated into the two vertical holes on top, one to supply compressed air, the other pressurized fuel oil. Doug Shafta would like to be involved in this, but he knows it's over his head technically, and he's got other duties, securing the defensive perimeter against gold seekers and whatever creepy crawly individuals Wing might have sent out to harass and sabotage them. But Doug has put the word out, and a whole lot of Doug's very interesting and well-traveled friends have converged on Golgotha from all over the world and are now camped out in foxholes in the jungle, guarding a defensive perimeter strung with monofilament tripwires and other stuff that Randy doesn't even want to know about. Doug just tells him to stay away from the perimeter, and he does. But Randy can sense Doug's interest in the central project here, and so when the big day comes, he lets Doug be the one to throw the switch. There is a lot of praying first. Abby's brought in a rabbi from Israel, and Enoch Root has brought in the Archbishop of Manila, and Goto Dango has flown in some Shinto priests, and various Southeast Asian countries have gotten in on the act, too. All of them pray or chant for the memory of their departed, though the prayers are practically drowned out by the choppers overhead. A lot of people don't want them disturbing Golgotha at all, and Randy thinks they are basically right. But he's gone out in Earth-imaged Wing's tunnel, this subterranean tentacle of air reaching towards the Horde, and released three-dimensional maps of everything to the media and made the case, reasonably well, he thinks, that it's better to do something constructive than to let it get ripped off by the likes of Wing. Some people have come around to his side, and some haven't, but none of the latter group is on the cover of Time and Newsweek. Doug Shafto is the last guy to take the floor. He removes his mesh-back cap, puts it over his heart, and with tears streaming down his face, says something about his father, whom he just barely remembers. He speaks of the Battle of Manila and of how he saw his father for the first time in the wreckage of the Church of San Augustine, and how his father carried him up and down the stairway there before going off to bring hellfire down upon the Nipponese. He speaks about forgiveness and certain other abstractions, and the words are all chopped up and blurred by the helicopters overhead, which only makes it more powerful as far as Randy's concerned, since it's basically all about a bunch of memories that are all chopped up and blurred in Doug's memory to begin with. Finally, Doug works his way around to some kind of resolution that is very clear in his heart and mind, but poorly articulated, and hits the switch. The pumps take a few minutes to pressurize Golgotha with a highly combustible mixture of air and fuel oil, and then Doug hits another switch that sets off a small detonation down below. Then the world shudders and rumbles before settling down into a kind of suppressed throbbing howl. A jet of white-hot flame shoots out of the drain hole down below, digs itself into the river very close to where Andrew Loeb came to rest, and throws up a cloud of steam that forces all of the choppers to gain altitude. Randy crawls down under the cover of that steam cloud, sensing it's the last privacy he'll ever have, and sits down by the edge of the river to watch. After half an hour, the jet of hot gas is joined by a rivulet of incandescent fluid that sinks to the bottom of the stream as soon as it emerges, clothed in a fuzz of wildly boiling water. For a long time, there is really nothing to be seen except steam. But after Golgotha has been burning for an hour or two, it becomes possible to see that underneath the shallow water, spreading down the valley floor, indeed right around the isolated boulder where Randy's perched, is a bright, thick river of gold.
We hope you've enjoyed this Macmillan Audio production of Cryptonomicon. Text copyright 1999 by Neil Stevenson. Production copyright 2009 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.